we've been looking at the life of Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles. I'd like you to turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 19. All right. You remember last week that we looked at the account of Jehoshaphat's foolish alliance with Ahab in the northern kingdom, and the result of it was the death of that wicked king of the north. But the follow-up of that account is really at the beginning of chapter 19. So the first part of what I'll be reading in 2 Chronicles 19 ties in more with last week, but also leads up to the account of further reformation that we'll be looking at this week. So let's start at 2 Chronicles chapter 19, verse 1. Then Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned safely to his house in Jerusalem. And Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Therefore the wrath of the Lord is upon you. Nevertheless, good things are found in you, and that you have removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God." So Jehoshaphat dwelt at Jerusalem, and he went out again among the people from Beersheba to the mountains of Ephraim, and brought them back to the Lord God of their fathers. Then he set judges in the land throughout all the fortified cities of Judah, city by city, and said to the judges, "Take heed to what you are doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord, who is with you in the judgment. Now, therefore, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Take care and do it, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no partiality nor taking of bribes. Moreover, in Jerusalem, for the judgment of the Lord and for controversies, Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites and priests and some of the chief fathers of Israel when they returned to Jerusalem. And he commanded them, saying, 'Thus you shall act in the fear of the Lord, faithfully and with a loyal heart. Whatever case comes to you from your brethren who dwell in their cities, whether of bloodshed or offenses against law or commandment, against statutes or ordinances, you shall warn them, lest they trespass against the Lord and wrath come upon you and your brethren. Do this, and you will not be guilty. And take notice, Amariah the chief priest is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Also the Levites will be officials before you. Behave courageously, and the Lord will be with the good.'" Now, this is only a short chapter, just 11 verses, but it's packed with very useful and interesting information. The first part of it, as I already mentioned, has to do with the return of Jehoshaphat from battle. And you remember the warning that Jehoshaphat had received with the king of Israel, that the battle would not succeed, and the prophecy is specifically given in verse verse 16 of the previous chapter. Micaiah had said that he saw the Lord say, "These have no master, let each return to his house in peace." Now, that was because the master, in that case the king of Israel, was to be slain. And Jehoshaphat is one of those who, it says in 2 Chronicles 19:1, does return in peace and safety. And so he received the blessing of the Lord's protection, you might say, in spite of his foolishness. And that leads then to the rebuke that he receives in verse 2. Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, comes out to meet him. And we've already seen this before, but the prophetic office, in as it functioned faithfully, at least in the southern kingdom, wasn't a fawning kind of office, you know, that told the ruler what a good job he was doing all the time, even when he wasn't doing a good job, or tried to butter up to him. Often there are rebukes for rulers and the prophets. All you have to do is read the prophetic books later on in the Bible to see if that's the case. And this is an example of that sort of prophetic rebuke. very straightforward in the statement with a question. Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord? Now, the word love and the reference to hate both can be used and probably are used in this case of a sort of an alliance. That is, as opposed to sort of an emotional love or hatred, it has to do with forming an alliance with someone. And so the loving of Ahab would refer, of course, to the forming of an alliance with Ahab, not only by giving the son of Jehoshaphat in marriage to the, giving them to be married to each other, but also in the supporting him in battle. So it's a severe rebuke in the sense that it puts in very stark terms with, it's not like a pretty good idea to Jehoshaphat, right? I mean, why don't I just, you know, I could have this guy's daughter marry my son, I get some money, I get a good political alliance, you know, the guy's in trouble, I'll go up and fight in the battle with him. And the rebuke is rather stark in contrast to that, to state exactly what's going on. You're loving those who hate the Lord, you're helping the wicked. It's phrased in different ways. And then the consequence is that the wrath of the Lord is upon you. I think it's probably worthwhile at this point to look ahead in the book. Later on, what happens with, first of all, in chapter 20, with the battle that comes up that Jehoshaphat has to face when many of the nations around him come against him in battle. You know, but probably even worse than that is the fact that the daughter of the northern kingdom, Athaliah, will later on kill his descendants. Okay, so the wrath of God coming on him, I think in some sense points forward to things that will occur, and you might say are, in that case, are really direct consequences of his own actions. But that's sort of looking ahead to things to come. That part is rather brief in terms of the rebuke. There is a word of commendation also in verse 3. It says, good things are found in you. Of course, good things are found in him because they were put there by God's grace. God worked in him. It's already been emphasized in Chronicles. But he gives specific examples of the good things in verse 3. You have removed the wooden images from the land and have prepared your heart to seek God. We already saw before his reform and worship, not in chapter 18, but the first chapter, chapter 17, about Jehoshaphat. Remember how he did go throughout the land and try to cleanse them from the sinful worship in which they participated. So that would be a reference to this. And then his own, that's really based on his own personal piety, you might say, that he's prepared his heart to seek God. Let me just remind you again that this idea of seeking God, which is so important in Chronicles, is not thought of something which somehow comes automatically or without effort on the part of the Christian, if I could use anachronistic language. Right? He prepared his heart to seek God, which refers to a certain diligence, or he set himself to seek God. And it's that setting of yourself to seek after God, which is a necessary aspect. Now, of course, as Paul writes to the Philippians, it's God who's at work in you to will and do of his good pleasure. And that's why you can work out your salvation with fear and trembling. There are two aspects of this, but the stress that's given here especially is that seeking after the Lord is something that requires a preparation of the heart, requires a certain setting of your heart to do it. And that's I think an aspect of growth in the Christian life that may be underemphasized in our day. Any comments or questions just on the first three verses there? Rebuke and commendation. Then let's look at the verses that follow. The verses that follow describe the actions of Jehoshaphat in response to this rebuke and commendation. And it is a noteworthy fact that Jehoshaphat didn't do what his father did, what his father did when he was rebuked. His father threw the guy in prison, right? He was angry, and he even oppressed some of the people. Jehoshaphat shows a more gracious response, a humble response before the rebuke of the Lord. And he follows up the acts for which he was commended in seeking to further the reformation that had already been started. And so it says in verse 4, he dwelt at Jerusalem. That would probably be to emphasize he didn't go up to the northern kingdom anymore. But he went out again among the people, it says, from Beersheba to the mountains of Ephraim, and brought them back to the Lord God of their fathers. So the first and the key thing that he sought to do was to turn the people to seek God. Now the means that he used isn't exactly given here, although I think part of the means would be what follows here in his setting up judges. It isn't the responsibility of kings to go around and preach all over the country, but presumably what he did was what he had done before in chapter 17. Remember how he sent out the priests and Levites to teach the law of the Lord. And so this is probably a description of his re-emphasis on that teaching ministry. And he may well have accompanied them personally in that work. And his desire was to turn them to seek God. Some of the commentators pointed out that the fact that he did make this alliance could well have been a serious offense, in the sense of a cause of stumbling to people. Right? I mean, here's a guy who worked so hard to teach the law of the Lord, and then he goes up and allies himself with Ahab. So that may be why he actually personally went throughout the land and exhorted them to seek after God. In any case, you should keep in mind that the hearts of the people are not a constant and devoted. I got myself into trouble with that sentence. Their hearts weren't always constantly devoted to God. There was a lot of growing and declining in terms of their spirituality. So much so that the chronicler can later say in chapter 20, verse 33, this is toward the end of the account of Jehoshaphat. It says, nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, for as yet the people had not directed their hearts to the God of their fathers. There are examples in Chronicles and Kings of godly rulers who sought to reform the worship of God and who did not find the people receptive, or at least not wholeheartedly receptive. They may have accomplished some reforms, and in some cases the people were turned. But it was often the case, and especially so later on, like in Jehoshaphat's time, where Jeremiah is preaching for them, that the people have very little interest, for the most part, in hearing of any reforms, and certainly not hearing what Jeremiah had to say. So that fact that he did seek to turn them to the God of their fathers is a commendable thing, and all the more so since he knew what a difficult job it was, and he still persevered in it. Just a couple of other comments. It's an interesting description. He says, from Beersheba to the mountains of Ephraim. That would be, remember the geography, from the south. Beersheba is usually described as the southern limit. So the mountains of Ephraim, which would be just over the border of what they would originally have controlled in the southern kingdom. So usually it's Dan to Beersheba, north to south, in the earlier descriptions. But the chronicler tends to go south to north for some reason. And that's the description here, but it's, again, the emphasis is that it's a rather thoroughgoing attempt at reformation and restoration. Now, he follows up on that with the part that I'd like to dwell on particularly today. As I said, this is a short chapter, but already there's a lot of rich material, and I especially want to focus on the last part. That is his setting of judges in the land. This is an example of how this dry and dusty history of the Old Testament is extremely relevant and helpful, and if thought through and applied even in the Christian churches, much less in a larger nation, would have a lot of benefit. He sets judges in the land throughout the fortified cities of Judah, and city by city. This account is really, you could say, broken up into two pieces. First, it talks about his setting up judges, you might say, in the outlying area. that some New Yorkers are biased. They say upstate New York. Upstate New York is everything outside of New York City. So this is sort of upstate Jerusalem or whatever, upstate Judah. Everything outside of Jerusalem is described here. He sets up this, and then he gives exhortations to the judges, the way they're supposed to rule. And then the whole thing is repeated. He talks about what goes on in Jerusalem. He sets up what is, I think we will see, is sort of like a Supreme Court or a Court of Appeals in Jerusalem. And then he gives a very similar exhortation to those rulers also. So if you read through this, and it sort of sounds like you're hearing the same thing twice, well, it doesn't hurt, right, to hear it twice, but it's also because of the way he's broken things up in terms of the outlying, what might be called the lower courts, and the highest court, or the higher court in the capital city of Jerusalem. Now, as I've tried to emphasize, or did at least a while ago, when the rulers are acting justly and rightly in Reformation, they're not making things up. That is, we already saw that when David, for example, brought in things about worship that were, in some sense, in addition to what would have been given by Moses, in some cases, the development of that, they were because God had directed him to do so. And similarly, as we've already seen in terms of the reforms that have been brought about under Asa and Jehoshaphat, those are based on God's word. So here, when Jehoshaphat does this, it's not like he's sitting around one day saying, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't we put some judges in the land? Okay. It's not that at all. In fact, what he's doing is restoring the system which was set up under Moses and also under David, as we'll see. That is, this is further reformation and restoration, not only to the worship of the church, you might say, but also the government of the church and of the state also. So I'd like to point that out a bit, because I don't know, it may not be completely familiar to you. So let's look at some of these references. Turn first to Exodus chapter 18. Unlike sometimes, I didn't fill the board with references. There are lots of references having to do with the setting up of the system of judgment, and especially to the qualification of judges, and to rebukes of bad judges. And I didn't put all those verses up. If you have a good cross-reference Bible or topical Bible or something like that, you can find, starting just at these passages in Exodus and Deuteronomy, you can find lots of references. But one of the foundational passages is in Exodus chapter 18. And you remember, this is the account where Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, is there. Moses is just wearing himself out, hearing all these cases. These people are lined up to bring the cases before him. And Moses explains, for example, in verse 16, when they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and another, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws. So Moses is there fulfilling the role of judge. The only problem is he's the only judge there is. Basically, at least that's the way it looks. He's the only one fulfilling this function. So Moses' father-in-law, in verse 17, says to him, to Moses, the thing that you do is not good. And so he proposes a system. And he says, let me pick it up at verse 19. Listen now to my voice. I will give you counsel, and God will be with you. Stand before God for the people, so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and the laws, and show them the way in which they must walk, and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but every small matter they themselves shall judge. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you will be able to endure, and all this people will also go to their place in peace. So Moses heeded the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. And Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. So they judged the people at all times. The hard cases they brought to Moses, but they judged every small case themselves. Now, you notice that even here, it's not an institution of the government based on a man's suggestion, although it comes from Jethro. It's clear enough in verse 23 that this is something which has to be a command of God, if God so commands you. And there's elsewhere given information in Numbers, for example, about the institution of such rule being given by God. But you see, the system that's set up here is what you might call a system of graded courts. That is, Moses was hearing all the cases, right? Even the pettiest thing, apparently, had to come to him. And what's said here is that you divide it up, you get a lot of judges, the lower judges, they're called, you know, like being called out. But anyway, the lower courts will hear the simpler cases, and if they're cases that they can't resolve, then those will go up to the higher courts. And that's, I think, familiar to us just with our own system of courts in the U.S. So that's the situation that was instituted here by God under Moses. And that's the sort of thing that Jehoshaphat is restoring. Notice further the qualifications for these judges, which will be, of course, a matter also of discussion in Chronicles. Able men, fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. Those sorts of qualifications I want you to keep in mind as we go through, but those are the men who were to be appointed as judges. Now, there are other accounts given, and I'd like to look at... I'm not careful here, I'll be carried away. Let's turn to just one more right now, Deuteronomy 16. Even though I have up there both Deuteronomy 16 and 17, the passages are very closely related to each other. I think what I'll do is read now from Deuteronomy 16, and then maybe we'll come back to chapter 17. So Deuteronomy 16, just verses 18 through 20 there. There's actually, as with the role of the priests and Levites in teaching, so with the role in judging and acting as officials, there's a lot of information in the book of Deuteronomy and in Chronicles, maybe more than other books. I think you can see that just from the verses I put up. But Deuteronomy 16, 18, "You shall appoint judges and officers in all your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with just judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, nor take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the righteous. You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you." So that's in the context of some different topics, including... The festivals, like the Passover, as mentioned earlier in the chapter. But this particular short passage has to do with the same idea of judges and emphasizes again the need for justice in the part of those who judge. It specifically mentions a bribe, and that will come up in Chronicles. Now, the point that I wanted to make from this is simply the fact that Jehoshaphat wasn't instituting a new system. He was seeking to restore the system that God has given, just as he did with the worship of God. And that's, I think, will become clear when we look later on at Deuteronomy 17 also. So before I go on, are there any comments or questions? Mark, see what I'm getting at? There are some of each, but you have to make a distinction between the civil courts and the ecclesiastical courts. So, yeah. Even that's an interesting issue. It's not. It's much more complicated than it might look at first. But basically, in terms of the ecclesiastical courts, it involved both what you might call ruling elders and the priests and Levites in the work. And in the civil matters, there was some role for the priests because, and that would be, you might say, only special to the nation of Israel and not a continuing thing. They had the Urim and the Thummim. They decided certain difficult cases and they gave advice on points of the law. The civil law of Israel was also in their domain. That was the book they studied. So. But in Chronicles, it may be kind of hard to dig all that out, but I think that's the overall picture. You're thinking back to these passages we just read. I'm sorry. Yes, that's right. And that's right. Yeah. You're anticipating our comments. That's exactly right. These were men who had to fear God.
There was a place for those who are angry.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. Yeah.
But the people who Moses was thinking had to
In the case of the passage in Exodus that we read, that's, I think, fairly clearly a civil court. And it is striking that they had the religious qualifications. I mean, it's striking from the secular American point of view. It's not striking from the biblical point of view. I said this is such a relevant passage. Maybe it just makes us depressed. But anyway, that's right. Yeah. Well, certainly, as you point out, they were supposed to be trained in the law. But what it is, they left out a lot. We leave out a lot of the qualifications that they expected. God expected. I'd like to, with that background information, just look a little bit at the verses here in Chronicles, some of the details, and look at some other of the Old Testament background. I was going to point out also that there are verses in Chronicles with some development under David, just as there was the worship. There's a further development of the role of judging, but I think we'll look at that. So let's look then at verse 6, and you'll see, having read those verses already in Exodus and Deuteronomy, that even the language that's used here echoes the qualifications. Take heed to what you are doing, for you do not judge for man, but for the Lord who is with you in the judgment. Now, therefore, let the fear of the Lord be upon you. Now, it's a very striking statement that he makes in verse 6. Well, first, the fact that they're to take heed. And this idea underlies a lot of what he says. It is they're supposed to be careful, or you might say cautious men. The role of judging puts you in a position of great responsibility. And it is a difficult thing. I think probably, as we think about this, okay, we can sort of gripe about our civil judges, but... And I'm not saying you were griping or anything, maybe I am. But we can think about the lack of qualifications, maybe, that are required in our land. But this, as I think we'll see later on, applies also to ecclesiastical courts, that is, to the elders who gather together to decide cases of justice or judgment. And if that seems still too remote, I think it's true that each of us in our daily lives has various judgments to make. If it's only, when little brother hits little sister and you can't get a word out what actually happened here, you have to make decisions, you have to make judgments. And certainly even in our work and other responsibilities, that sort of thing comes up. In all of those, the point I want to make is that the fact that you're to be careful, take heed, that is, take seriously the responsibility that God has given you, whatever it is, at whatever level you judge, I think underlies a lot of it. And these are very sobering verses, I'll tell you, as someone who does sit in ecclesiastical courts. Because what he says is, you do not judge for man, but for the Lord. What he's saying is that you are not man's representative. Ultimately, you're God's representative. God has put you there as the judge. And God is holding you responsible to be a faithful judge. It's a very sobering thought. And that idea has been developed later on because he gives the attributes of God. He says God doesn't take bribes, God doesn't show partiality. And the implication is, then you as his representative had better not either, because you're acting on behalf of God. And so the fact that they acted on behalf of God is stressed here and is a very fundamental, sobering fact. And that means, first of all, that God is with those who act faithfully. And again, that's developed through the passage. I'm trying to summarize a little bit. But it also means that those who act unfaithfully will find God's severest judgment on themselves. And that sort of idea comes up in many interesting ways. I put up there just one reference. Psalm 82 is an interesting verse which Christ himself points to. And it talks about God the Lord judging among what he calls the gods, who are the civil rulers, probably the judges in that case. And he rebukes them. But it's as if the supreme judge comes down to the earthly judges and says, you guys are not judging faithfully. What a, you know, what a terrifying picture that is, that of the supreme judge coming among the lower judges. So that's the, I wanted to bring out some of the basic information that's given in verse 6 in terms of the setting. They were to look at themselves not as human representatives. You know, it's tempting to think that way. Well, you know, the judge, he should act this way because this is the way the people feel. This is what the opinion polls show. But a faithful judge is going to judge the way he should judge, in justice. And, of course, there are lots of things to take into account. I already said it's not a simple matter. It's a difficult thing to be a faithful judge. And yet the fundamental fact is that he's not judging for himself, but for God. And the consequence of that, of course, is in verse 7 is, now therefore let the fear of the Lord be upon you. This is a no-brainer, right? If you're judging in place of God, you don't say, hey, look at me, I'm God's representative. Instead you say, I better fear God. I should rule in all humility, knowing that I have a higher judge to report to be accountable to. And again he says, take care in verse 7. The implication then is a similar sort of thing, that it requires cautiousness. Now, the last part of verse 7 brings out the idea that I mentioned already. That is, if you are judging for God, then you must be people like God. You must be godly people, especially in your judging. Again, it's not difficult to understand, but more difficult to do, but he says at the end of verse 7, for there is no iniquity with the Lord our God, no partiality, nor taking of bribes. Now that idea of partiality and taking of bribes is, of course, a central difficulty with any system of justice. And that is, the system of justice can be easily corrupted by men seeking favors, and men seeking favors especially by bribes, by giving gifts. And again, you only have to read through the Bible, especially a lot of the Old Testament, to realize what a problem this was. The book of Proverbs talks again and again about the seriousness of taking a bribe. And I thought I would look at one or two passages here. Let's look at Deuteronomy 1, 15 to 18. I only put up a few verses, and I sort of feel obliged to look at the ones you put up, but I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to do that. Deuteronomy 1, I don't want to skip some of these, though. Deuteronomy 1, 15 to 18, again, describes, in some sense, this is the re-giving of Exodus 18. Deuteronomy has a lot of retelling of the commands already given. And Moses in Deuteronomy 1 is describing what he did. For example, in verse 15, so I took the heads of your tribes, wise and knowledgeable men, and made them heads over you. Talks about leaders of thousands and so forth. And then he says in verse 16, then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your brethren, and judge righteously between a man and his brother, or the stranger who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid in any man's presence, for the judgment is God's. See, there's exactly that same idea. The judgment is God's. The sobering thought. The case that is too hard for you, bring to me, and I will hear it. So there's that same idea, of course, of the graded courts, but also the emphasis on fairness, not showing partiality, and the fact that the case is God's. I'd like to look at some other references along these lines in Exodus chapter 23. For example, maybe I don't need to dwell on this point, but I think it is helpful for nothing else to realize that Jehoshaphat is seeking to guard against what was a very common problem, and he does it using the language of the institution of the original institution of the system of justice. I put up there Exodus 23, 1 through 9. I'd like to read first just verses 6 through 9, and then come back to one other verse. Exodus 23, verse 6. You shall not pervert the judgment of the poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Now the context here may not be specifically having to do with civil rulers, although there's certainly much in the context here about what crime is worthy of death, so that would seem to be maybe the most relevant application. But you see, especially talks about those who would be most vulnerable to partiality, those who would be most vulnerable to a corrupt judge, and those would be the poor. They don't have the money to counter the bribe, and the stranger, those who probably wouldn't know the system or know people in the system. There's an emphasis here that there should be a fair dealing regardless of the situation. But interestingly enough, although that's the case, notice what he says in verse 3. This is a verse I skipped up above. It says, you shall not show partiality to the poor man in his dispute. So it's not as if you should be careful. Make sure you don't show partiality make sure you don't act corruptly toward the poor, but it doesn't have the implication. So, just give him the benefit of the doubt or somehow. You can be partial toward him. It's supposed to be justice. That is, the poor man is supposed to receive his justice, but you're not supposed to show partiality to him. And there's a similar reference in the book of Leviticus, but much the same statement, that the poor are not supposed to receive impartiality. Now you may say, well, that's not likely to happen very often, but there, I don't know, men do funny things. So this is what's striking to me is the, you don't tremble at this word, balance, the scriptural balance that is in giving, both the warning not to oppress the poor is also the warning not to be partial toward the poor, if that's balancing. I guess that's what I mean by it. It's a very carefully laid out system. And that then is developed a little further. Okay, one more reference. Deuteronomy 10:17-19. This may look more like a study in Deuteronomy, but you'll bear with me. Deuteronomy 10:17-19. This emphasizes again the fact that judges must judge justly without impartiality. But it shows again the idea that's developed in Chronicles. That is, this is done because you are to judge for God, and He doesn't judge that way. Deuteronomy 10:17. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. There, especially verse 17, the emphasis on the fact that God does not show partiality. God doesn't take a bribe. It's a strange picture of someone trying to bribe God, but I think we can imagine applications of that. In any case, God is not swayed by those sorts of things. He is just, and so the judges are to be that way. So that's... Let's go back to 2 Chronicles 19, at least for a while. That's the emphasis then in 2 Chronicles 19. And again, it's based on development in the Mosaic system. It's of what it means for God to be just. So the exhortation given in verse 7 then follows on that. And after that exhortation, as I said, he turns from upstate Judah to Jerusalem, to the capital, and it describes in verse 8, moreover in Jerusalem, for the judgment of the Lord and for controversies, Jehoshaphat appointed some of the Levites and priests and some of the chief fathers of Israel when they returned to Jerusalem. And there's a commandment that follows then, verse 9, which as I pointed out is very similar to what we've already seen. He commands them that they should act in the fear of the Lord, faithfully, with a loyal heart. So these are men who are supposed to act justly, but justice requires a heart that's right before God. And there's a description then in verse 10 of something of the process. Whatever case comes to you from your brethren who dwell in the cities, and there's some descriptions there, it's not entirely clear what all of these sorts of disputes would be. They would probably have to do with difficult cases of the law where one person might plead one statute against another statute. In other words, maybe a dispute of interpreting the law. That may be the reference there to against law or commandment, statutes or ordinances. But you see, especially in verse 10, the same idea that these are disputes that are coming to them from the cities. And it's because of this and the language echoing the passage in the book of Deuteronomy that this seems to be a description of, again, a graded court, where Jerusalem was the highest court, the court of appeals. And so he seems to be describing difficult cases that they would have to deal with coming to them out of that situation of an appeal. The interesting things, yeah, let's see. I'll hold off on looking at the parallel reference in just a second. The exhortations that he gives, as I said, are similar to what were said before, but developed a little bit further. It's interesting, it says, "You shall warn them." So this has to do with the fact that the judge not only has to mete out justice, but also has the role of something of an exhorter to do what is right, to give warning to those. And you can hear that happen even in our judicial system sometimes. A judge will give the guy a lecture after he hands down the sentence. And that's probably the sense here, although we hope it has more effect than just a little lecture. The sobering fact that's given at the end of verse 10 is that lest they trespass against the Lord and wrath come upon you and your brethren. Do this and you will not be guilty. So there is the idea that is, I think, again, a familiar one. For example, in the book of Ezekiel, that men who have these positions of responsibility are told to warn people. And if they fail to warn people and people sin, then some of the responsibility is on their own head. Right? If they fail to blow the trumpet, that's the picture that's used in Ezekiel, then some of the responsibility is on their own. Of course, the people who sin bear their own responsibility as well. But that's the idea here, I think, that wrath will come on you if you are not careful to warn the people about the seriousness of the crime or sin that they commit. That idea is, I think, an important one to keep in mind. Here I'm sort of rushing ahead. Verse 11 has another further information about it. And that's that what he's talking about is apparently a system, really two systems, two court systems. He says, Amariah, the chief priest, is over you in all matters of the Lord, and Zebediah, the son of Ishmael, the ruler of the house of Judah, for all the king's matters. Now, this sort of distinction is one I think I pointed out 2 weeks ago when we talked about ascending the teachers through the land. This apparently would refer both to a civil system of courts and to an ecclesiastical system of courts. That is, as I tried to argue at the very beginning of the study, there was a separation of church and state, to use the modern term, in the land of Israel as God set it up. There was a civil magistrate with rulers under him, and there were church rulers, priests and Levites, and there were separate responsibilities for each, and there were also separate court systems. This reference here to one being over you, his being a civil ruler, and one being over you, his being an ecclesiastical ruler, is simply a further indication of what we've already seen. And I put up this reference in 1 Chronicles 26 as another example of that same idea. This is something that could be developed a good bit more, and if it sounds incredible to you, like you've never thought through it, I don't have time to develop it more, but just think about examples of Moses and Aaron, of Nehemiah. And what did Nehemiah do? He, as the governor, the first thing he did was call Ezra the priest, so that he could administer what you might call the ecclesiastical aspect, not the religious aspect. I'm not saying that Nehemiah had no religious responsibilities as a ruler, but he called Ezra. And there are further references throughout the scriptures to this sort of distinction in responsibility. The best reference for this is a book written 350 years ago by George Gillespie, Aaron's Rod Blossoming. And Gillespie particular points to this passage, but has a whole chain of other passages. Because Gillespie was dealing with the encroachment of the civil magistrate on the church. Sounds familiar. In his day, the so-called Erastian view was popular, especially in England. The Erastian view was really that the king had authority over the church. And the highest court of appeals, for example, if you were excommunicated by the church, the highest court of appeals was the king. The king could overturn the excommunication. And if you think about the implications just of that, as well as in other areas, you see something of the danger to the church and why the Covenanters died the way they did in later on in Scottish church history. Listen to the other class, I'll get to that. But that idea of the separate systems, then, that there was both an ecclesiastical supreme court and a civil supreme court in Jerusalem, is something Gillespie spends a good bit of time arguing about and proving from the scriptures to show that the Erastian system was unbiblical, didn't even describe what took place in the Old Testament, certainly not in the New Testament either. Well, the book is in print. You can buy it if you want, but that's a good reference for, well, written in Gillespie's style, but anyway, it's a good reference for that sort of discussion of separation. Let me try to try to wrap this up a little bit. The concluding comments that he makes there are that they should behave courageously and the Lord will be with the good. That is a promise at the end there of a blessing. I've tended to emphasize the dangers, right? You act unjustly, you've got to stand before the great God, the great judge. But there's also a promise of blessing, that God will be with the good. And I think in the sense of those who really seek him will find wisdom, which is very difficult. Judging, as I've already said, is not a simple matter. And there's a promise of God's blessing, both in aiding them in their work, and I think in just a general sense of blessing. But there's also a call to courage, which is one of the most difficult things for judges, or one of the most needed characteristics of judges, to act courageously in the face of many pressures to do the things that are just and fair. I'd like maybe just to look at this passage in Deuteronomy, one other passage. I'll close. Deuteronomy 17, 8-13. I think it in some ways summarizes what we've been saying and shows the biblical nature of the exhortations that Jehoshaphat gives. We just read Deuteronomy 16 with the warnings that were given there against impartiality and the falling after God instead. Deuteronomy 17, verse 8, if a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge, between degrees of guilt for bloodshed, between one judgment or another, or between one punishment or another, matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. Again, let me pause here. You see how the language is very similar to that language in that verse, you know, cases of bloodshed, difficult matters to decide. So here again is the exhortation to go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. That is the highest court, the court of appeals. And then verse 9, and you shall come to the priests, the Levites, and to the judge there in those days, and inquire of them. They shall pronounce upon you the sentence of judgment. You shall do according to the sentence which they pronounce upon you in that place which the Lord chooses. And you shall be careful to do according to all that they order you. According to the sentence of the law in which they instruct you, according to the judgment which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left from the sentence which they pronounce upon you. Now the man who acts presumptuously and will not heed the priest who stands to minister there before the Lord your God or the judges, that man shall die. So you shall put away the evil from Israel. And the people shall hear and fear and no longer act presumptuously. So there's something about the enforcement of the decrees that are made. But there's the same sort of distinction there, the priests and the Levites, and there are the judges. There seem, again, to be two systems there, and the system of appeal. also. The Levites are sometimes said to be judges and sometimes said to be officials. And officials means those who actually execute the sentence, who make sure the sentence is carried out. And the Levites seem to have carried out both roles. But let me try to wrap this up just by making some comments. Maybe these are already obvious. We've already discussed them, but I'd like to wrap it up a bit. First of all, there's simply the fact that we've already noted that there were religious qualifications for all the judges, not only for the church rulers, not only for the elders of the church, which you would expect, but also for the civil judges. And then, of course, it's true, if you read through the Pentateuch, that's obviously the same thing that's true at any for any civil ruler, whether it's a judge or not. They're all required to fear God and to rule in the fear of God. And I put up there the 2 Samuel 23 statement that David makes, a very general one: the one who rules must rule in the fear of God. And that, of course, is a matter which should be taken into account in any nation. Any nation which is covenanted to be the Lord's will also covenant to appoint only rulers who fear God. Okay, it's unconstitutional. All right, but that's one of the defects, I would say, in the way the American system is set up. There is no religious test for rulers. And that was a novelty when the American system was set up, that there was no such test. So that's one point I want to make, and I think we can see well enough the corruption that comes with men who do not fear God. Having a system requiring people to profess to be Christians, of course, isn't going to root out corruption. Don't get me wrong. But you don't even have a basis for talking about fearing God and ruling as God rules if you don't have men who profess to believe in the God who is impartial. The other point I'd like to make is maybe this is also controversial, but that is that there was a system of appeals. And so you see something of the danger of even an ecclesiastical system in which congregations are isolated and afford no opportunity for appeal. If there's only one court and there's no appeal to a higher court, you can see the danger and the difficulty you get in. And even people who analyze the American church scene, you know, in suits against churches, realize that fact. If you have a church which has a system where congregations cooperate and there's a method of appeal, you're a lot better off, even from a legal point of view, than a church which just has isolated congregations and no reason to appeal. Right? You got maybe a pastor, maybe some elders. You take the case before them. If they don't like it, that's it. There's no reason for appeal. Whereas the biblical system, as I think we've seen here and you can see elsewhere, doesn't allow for appeal to higher courts. And that's another matter which I think is worth pondering. Okay, comments or questions? This was supposed to be not such a long lesson, but famous last words. Oh, come on, this is so controversial. You guys got to see. There we go. Yeah.
In verse 6 here, it
says... Are we in Chronicles?
Yeah, back to Chronicles.
Okay.
Back to verse 7.
Uh-huh.
A little phrase, let the fear of the Lord be upon you.
Yes. But that's certainly underlying that. Any growth in
this phrase.
It doesn't sound like a particularly spiritual thing to do, we might say. But we should keep in mind that he had already sent teachers through the land. Presumably he was seeking to keep that going. But there's also the point is well made that along with that there is the need to make sure there's a good system in place to deal with the cases of discipline. That's, I think, a serious problem in churches generally, is the lack of dealing with this. And because it is difficult, it's not an easy thing to do. I can't say for myself that I'm as diligent as I should be, given my own responsibilities. But it's striking. Part of his reformation is that it's important. Himself has been subject to discipline for going up to align himself as they have. Which he already received at the start of the chapter, the review. Okay, well, let's stop here then.